Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
If I Must Die by Rifat Alarir. If I must die, you must live, to tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings. Make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza, while looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze and bid no one farewell, not even to his flesh, not even to himself, sees the kite, my kite you made, flying up above, and thinks for a moment, an angel is there, bringing back love. If I must die, let it bring hope, let it be a tale. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU. I thought I would begin with If I Must Die by Rifat Alarir, the martyred poet, educator of Gaza, of Palestine, and his iconic work, which has inspired so many people in the Palestine Solidarity Movement, That was a poem that I did last night at the Guelph Poetry Slam. I've been doing it for months now. Basically, every month I just go to the Poetry Slam and I do that poem in solidarity with Gaza, in solidarity with Palestine. And I did it again last night. And it was especially poignant because, of course, I was doing it in solidarity with the encampment, the pro-Palestine encampment at the University of Guelph, which unfortunately was had to disband, had to decamp on the 15th of this month, 15th of July, 2024. Because, well, the admin, they were playing hardball. And the thing is, I know it's all the same people. Like from years ago when I was actually studying at the University of Guelph, it was the same people in admin back then. They just were lower down and they all kissed a lot of ass and they all got promoted. And so of course they were the ones who were involved in cracking down on Palestine solidarity on campus and given all the usual BS reasons as to why, you know, threatened to bring the police in and all that stuff. The same as in Toronto and all the other, and Western and all the other places where it's happened in this province and throughout North America. But it's not over. And I really stress that. I stressed that last night that it's not over. I've been stressing that to so many people. It's not over. The resistance is still going on. It's going on in Gaza. It's going on in Palestine. It's going on throughout West Asia and around the world. And the amount of solidarity that Palestine's getting is just incredible. And I want to dedicate this show to talking about how Palestine is succeeding and how Israel is just being ground down. The apartheid state is being ground down so much. You know, and it will be defeated. You know, even though there's immense suffering going on, like definitely not minimizing that. Victory will be won. And I actually sang a song called The March of the Volunteers. It's a song that almost anybody in the Chinese-speaking world would know. And, you know, there's been a lot of solidarity for Palestine in the Chinese-speaking world. And it's no surprise because, I mean, they were in a very similar position in the 1920s, the 1930s, when they were being besieged and occupied. The Japanese were invading. There were still, you know, Imperial European and American concessions in Shanghai and parks that Chinese people weren't allowed to walk in. That were reserved for Westerners. You know, they understand what occupation and colonization means. They were at the receiving end of that. And the song I sang last night, The March of the Volunteers, was written by... written in the 1930s, in the early 1930s. And Paul Robeson sang it, I think for the first time in the West around 1950. And there's a guy, I think he very much wanted to go to China, but he couldn't because the U.S. State Department blacklisted him and took away his passport. You know, he was on the McCarthyite hit list back in the day for his international solidarity and for his calls for justice for black Americans at home. But he sang this song. He sang it in Chinese and he sang it in English. I'm going to sing it in English for you right now. I did it last night for the people at the Poetry Slam. A cappella version. I'm always nervous when I do that. But I'm going to do it again. This is a song born in the struggle of the brave Chinese people. It begins, Qi Lai, arise, you who refuse to be bond slaves. And ends, Chen Jing, march on. Arise, you who refuse to be bond slaves. Let's stand up and fight for liberty and true democracy. All our world is facing the chains of the tyrant. Everyone who works for freedom is now crying. Arise, arise, arise. All of us with one heart, with the torch of freedom, march on with the torch of freedom. March on, march on, march on and on. That's the message that I want to give to the folks who were in the Palestine encampment at the University of Guelph, and also the, and it's a message that the people of Gaza and the people of Palestine already know. March on. March on to victory. Now, what I want to begin here with the show, the first clip I want to play actually is from the Electronic Intifada just this past week. And they were talking, Ali Abu Nima was talking about how to a correspondent, Abdul Jawad, one of the correspondents in the West Bank, the occupied West Bank, about just the way many people on the Western left, they don't understand the importance of armed resistance and armed struggle in Palestine and in anti-colonial movements more general. By the way, this is a relatively new thing. I mean, they understood it much, much more in, say, the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s. I mean, there was a lot of solidarity with independent struggles, anti-colonial movements in the global south in those days. But that's really kind of tapered off in more recent years. And there's been a lot of, I would say very condescending treatment of this question by many on the Western left who think that armed struggle is a bad thing, and resistance always should be peaceful. Not understanding that sometimes resistance cannot be peaceful. It simply is not allowed to be peaceful by the occupier, by the colonizer. And that definitely is the case in Palestine. So that's what the Electronic Intifada addressed here. And I think it's very important for us to know and understand. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Abdul Jawad, I wanted to kind of follow that thread a little bit, I'll tee it up for Ali. But the essay that you wrote several months ago for Mondo Weiss about the role of the so-called Western left and how it looks at Palestinian resistance in this very condescending and paternalistic and racist lens. And this notion that Palestinians are only like Westerners really show that their sympathies only go to Palestinians when they're victims, when they're being bombed, and not when they're resisting. And this very it's a very important essay that I want our listeners and viewers to read, obviously. But Ali, if you had any specific questions about it.
Yeah, it's a great essay, and we have it up on the screen now, and it's in Mondo Weiss, published at the end of May. And this is a question that I've written about, Joseph Masshad has written about, others have written about, but you did such a brilliant job bringing so many strands of this question together in this essay, and it's particularly crucial at this moment. And you say at the end of it, this isn't a spoiler, but I think it's almost the thesis of the piece. You say the left must confront this basic fact. One cannot ground solidarity with Palestine on a politics that dismisses, overlooks, or excludes Hamas. This stance fails to grasp the complexities and contradictions inherent in the Palestinian struggle. In doing so, the left overlooks the dividing line between collaboration and resistance at its peril. We've already touched on some of these themes in the discussion, but can you just elaborate on this point? What was sort of the main point you wanted to get across? And what's been the reaction to this since you published this essay at the end of May? And I know that you've also spoken about it at greater length in other interviews and discussions, which people can find the videos of.
Well, I think, I was trying to fend off a lot of the attacks that are being launched at Hamas, specifically for being a socially regressive force, trying to also give people a picture of the main dividing line in Palestinian politics. It's not a dividing line between secularism and Islamism. It's not a dividing line between, you know, socially progressive, you know, agenda or, you know, Islamist agenda. The dividing line is between the politics of defiance and resistance, since we live in this kind of horizon of what we just described earlier of annihilation and ethnic cleansing, and one that, you know, has taken a position for a lot of reasons historically to bet on survival through collaboration and cooperation and accommodation with Israel. And that if we want to be serious about, you know, solidarity with the Palestinians and solidarity with their cause, we cannot exclude the forces that are the more energetic, the ones that are actually placing their neck on the line, the ones that are actually designing tunnel networks and ensuring that Palestine lives in the 21st century, ensuring that the Palestinian cause has resonance across the world, ensuring that the solidarity and international solidarity movement is now reacting to what the Palestinian resistance was able to accomplish through the shock it induced in Israeli society on October 7th. So you have to at least take into account that these are the forces that are, you know, leading the struggle. And what I mentioned historically is that Palestinians, while they were disunited in many instances, they generally defined the enemy as being the settler colonial regime. The Second Intifada is an example. And they engage in disunity and on organizational terms, but they directed the struggle against Israel. So you had Fatah, you had Hamas, you had the PFLP, DFLP, all engaged in conducting operations and resistance actions against Israel. Now the dividing line is not there. You know, you can stand in solidarity with Mahmoud Abbas, but that doesn't mean much. You can stand in solidarity with somebody that is ensuring that his own people are heading towards ruins and, you know, another Nakba, and without even a battle to be proud of, even if we lose the war overall. So this is the problem that I think people should grapple with. At the end, politics is about choices you make based on the forces on the ground. It's not about necessarily idealistic forces. And I think the second point of the piece was, you know, in resistance itself, there's something progressive. Empowers people. It empowers. It expands the imagination of people. It provides exhilarating moment. It has an effective and it has an affective structure to it that also goes beyond those who practice it or their ideologies. So if Hamas is doing much of the resistance at this current moment in Palestinian history, first of all, that doesn't mean that secular leftist forces have not been engaged and still are engaged, as we have seen unfold in Gaza. But more importantly, that in resistance itself, there is a progressive element that we should not overlook or exclude. And having a Islamist political party, or an Islamic revivalist party, leading now the struggle does not mean that we should shy or shun away from engaging with this political formation and ensuring that it gets all the support it needs to sustain itself on the ground and to sustain the struggle moving forward in the future.
That's very well put. And I'll just say, as I'm listening to you, I'm reflecting that, you know, the Islamic or Islamist nature of the identity, let's say, of the resistance rather than nature, is not a problem for Palestinians. I mean, that it's not controversial for Palestinians in general. I mean, yes, there are, as you said, there's a few, and there's always people who dissent, but the vast majority of Palestinians see strength in that. They see faith as giving people really an anchor to survive so much utter horror, and their faith becomes even more important at a time like this. It's a problem for, you know, the Western left. But in that context, I want to say that the Islamic identity of a movement was never a problem for the Western Empire, for the American Empire, when it served them. So, for example, they didn't mind, you know, going back to the 1950s, the United States actually fostered and promoted reactionary Islamist movements as tools of its empire. And one of the most grotesque expressions of that was the U.S. support for the Afghan so-called Mujahideen in the 1980s against the Soviet Union forces, which later gave birth to Al-Qaeda and some of the more extreme expressions of that. And we saw that in Syria, the United States and Israel were happy to finance and arm and support and whitewash very extreme groups, up to and including ISIS, when it served their agenda. So I'm making that point to say that this is often really a distraction, and it's really up to Palestinians to define the identity and the nature of their resistance, and for Palestinians internally to do their politics, you know, and it's really not a question for others to define. But in the context of Western solidarity, it's you did such an important and good job of sort of sweeping away some of those red herrings in the way of solidarity.
Thanks, Ali. No, I mean, I think I agree with you. And I think that there is a level to this discussion. I mean, nobody's at the end, you know, telling the left in the global north, you know, come and fight here in Palestine. At the end, you know, the coalition, you know, that is operating the Palestine Solidarity Movement, the Palestinians have asked, you know, to ensure that they pressure their own governments to end the impunity of Israel, to ensure that there's sanctions, divestment. You know, that's what, you know, people across the world can do for the Palestinians to ensure that Israel and its leaders are held accountable for all the crimes that are being committed in Palestine more broadly. And, you know, but you shouldn't be distracted with this kind of assault on Hamas or the Islamic nature or if its ideology as a reason to back off or back away from support of the Palestinian cause. Again, Hamas is not practicing anything new that the leftists didn't practice in Palestine as well. And much of the left is also aligned with Hamas in Palestine. And much of it is also aligned, at least on the level of resistance and working together now in Gaza against the Israeli army. So in many instances and in many cases, I mean, this discussion is just becomes a distraction for the wider, I think, solidarity movement and what it should be focusing on.
Well, I think that's a good place to leave it for now. So much to chew on, and we're always so grateful for your wisdom and analysis. Again, I want people to find your essay on Mondo Weiss. Maybe we can put it up one more time if we still have it. Abdul Jawad, you are a lecturer at Beer Zeit University in the Occupied West Bank. You've written many essays. You're a frequent guest on many podcasts, including Millennials Are Killing Capitalism. There's the essay, The Question of Hamas and the Left, published May 31st of this year on Mondo Weiss. Please come back again sooner than...
happy to come back anytime, Chris. Thank you for having me again.
You're listening to Back in USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and that was Rage Against the Machine with War Within a Breath. Before then, we had the Electronic Intifada, talking about armed resistance in Palestine, the critical nature that that plays in the struggle of the people in Gaza and the people in the West Bank and the wider region. And I want to go to now what is, some more specific examples, you could say, in that struggle, because recently there was kind of it was a big deal. You had a drone, an attack drone from Yemen, from the Ansar Allah movement, that managed to penetrate Israeli air defenses and detonate in Tel Aviv, about a block away from the American consulate. And this was a big deal. This basically said the resistance is basically overcoming the Israeli defenses, the Israeli Iron Dome, or whatever it is they call it. And that just shows the apartheid state is increasingly vulnerable. And like I say, it's being ground down by resistance on all sides. And it's fundamentally losing this conflict. And there was a really good report by independent journalist Danny Haifong, which went into all this and why it is significant. So I want to play that right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
On July 19th, Ansar Allah, the Houthis, as they are called, in the collective West, in the U.S. warmongering sphere, Ansar Allah laid a major blow to Israel's air defense systems. And really, you could say the entirety of its so-called military superiority when it launched the Yaffa drone, an unmanned aerial vehicle, into Tel Aviv, close to the U.S. embassy, killing one Israeli and causing significant enough damage to warrant mass hysteria among those who are currently igniting the region on fire, from Israel, from the United States, the U.K. They all have taken major umbrage with this move, and we're about to get to that. But before we do, I want to show you exactly what happened here. Okay, so this is the initial report. One Israeli died from Yemen's first drone strike on Tel Aviv. A total failure of the Iron Dome has worried the Israeli military. If Yemen can strike from 2,500 kilometers, then Hezbollah has the same capabilities. Indeed, that is a big concern. And here's another report on this. Okay, here's another report. It says, from Hebrew sources, Israeli sources, estimated in Israel that the so-called Houthi drone was in the air for approximately 10 hours during its flight from Yemen to Tel Aviv. It carries an explosive warhead weighing 10 kilograms. And there you see the drone as it was making its way into the area where it finally exploded. Now, this drone showed the whole world that not only is the Iron Dome penetrable, but Israel's entire military is just not capable of tracking this kind of technology from that entire distance. We're talking about not only Israel, but possibly so-called allies or even vassals, or those who are just completely wedded to Israel in some respects, even Saudi Arabia, we could say, given its stance on this issue, lip service on the one hand to the Palestinian cause, of course, and continue to collaborate with Israel in many respects. Yemen had to take a long road to launch this drone and to ensure that it exploded. So this was huge, and it incurred a vast response from Israel. Now, we're going to get to the response from Israel and then why this response is ultimately going to be a failure. So here we have what Israel did the day after. On July 20th, Israel attacks Yemeni civilian facilities while Sana'a vows a heavy price. So this is from Al-Mayadeen. Their correspondent reports that civil defense teams continue to battle blazing fires that erupted due to Israeli aggression on oil storage facilities. So what ended up happening was Israel sent war jets to launch a series of military strikes on Yemen in the province of Hodeidah on the Red Sea coast. Israel is saying it was a military target. Yemen is reporting that there have been many martyrs, people who have died as well as those wounded. We don't know, of course, their character. It's likely civilians have died in this, as is usually the case in anything Israel does. But it says the aggression targeted an oil refinery, leading to a massive fire that can be seen kilometers away. Al-Mayadeen's correspondent reported that the airstrikes targeted the Ras Khatib power station in Hodeidah, igniting the oil storage facilities. The Yemeni Ministry of Health reported that martyrs and wounded were a result of the aggression, confirming that civilians suffered severe burns during the fire. Israeli Khan 11 channel, citing a U.S. official, reported that Israelis conducted the attack on Yemen. And there you can see, I'm not going to play the video, but you can see the fires that occurred. So there are civil defense teams battling to extinguish the fire and flames, noting that the size of the blaze is making that task very difficult. These airstrikes were coordinated between U.S. and Israeli forces, indicating the nature of the targets hit. Now, another report that's not here that is now, I don't know if it's confirmed or not, but Italy supposedly helped refuel the Israeli jets that were on the way, the F-35 fighters that were used to strike Yemen. And then what did Yemen say? They said, this is... Mohammed Abdul Salam, head of Yemen's negotiating delegation, said that the brutal Israeli aggression will only increase the determination and steadfastness of the Yemeni people and its brave armed forces in an escalating manner. And indeed, even before this strike, this is what Yemen was promising. Here is what the Ansarallah had to say. Okay. They said they are going to escalate operations and collaborate with the resistance on all fronts. It confirms its operation against the Israeli occupation will only escalate as long as the aggression on Gaza continues. So remember, this is about Gaza for Yemen. This is not about themselves. They're not going to let Israel deter them because of these airstrikes. Not only these strikes are not going to deter them because U.S. and Royal Navy strikes haven't deterred them, but it will only make their determination that much more steadfast. And you say, Danny, why? That seems suicidal. No, this is existential for Ansarallah. They see themselves as part of this entire war that's been going on. Remember, what has happened to Yemen over the last decade plus in genocide in and of itself, launched by the United States, supported by Israel, the UAE, Saudi Arabia being the leaders. Of course, Israel, not the leader necessarily. So Saudi Arabia, UAE, the United States sponsoring them, and Israel being a major supporter of the destabilization and the destruction in Yemen, the hunger, the famine, these absolutely genocidal military operations. We can go on and on and on, but Yemen knows what this is like. They are coming to the defense of Gaza, now experiencing its own genocide. So according to Yemen's Deputy Minister of Information, Yemeni escalation that targeted Tel Aviv is one that will lead to the military defeat of Israel, said Fahmy al-Yusufi. Speaking to al-Mayadeen, al-Yusufi remarked that the escalation is also a message directed to a NATO coalition that says Sana'a will not stand idly by as the enemy massacres Gaza. According to the Yemeni official, Yemen is escalating attacks deep into occupied territories, essentially targeting Israeli decision-making and subduing the occupation. Similarly, Ansarallah Politburo member Hizam al-Assad told al-Mayadeen that the operation was the first among upcoming escalatory operations, adding that Israel should feel its head across all its cities as what is to come is greater than what has been done as long as the aggression on Gaza continues. We are furthering a new strategic phase in operations against the enemy, noting that Yemeni armed forces are integrated with the resistance in Lebanon, Iraq, and Palestine. So they're promising more, and they have more at their disposal. Okay, this is another report. A source in the Yemeni armed forces reveals to al-Mayadeen, Yemen will continue escalating in the face of Israel until it ceases aggression. It has a vast supply of those drones used on Tel Aviv. The drone Yaffa used in their fighter operation on Tel Aviv was developed after Arab countries intercepted Yemeni weapons aimed at Umm al-Rashrash, Eilat, an informed source told al-Mayadeen. The source further stated that the stockpile of such drones is very large and emphasized that this is not the last weapon of its kind, noting that American reports about intercepting these drones are inaccurate. The source highlighted that military operations on occupied Yaffa are coinciding with naval operations according to objectives announced by the Yemeni army, affirming all operations will continue unabated. So Yaffa, remember, this is what they're calling Tel Aviv before the formation of Israel, okay? That's why they called it that. The source explained that the Yemeni armed forces statement revealed complete readiness for changes, emphasizing that the operation is part of escalatory steps that will not be reversed. They are not going to reverse it, okay? The operation in question was conducted by the newly developed Yaffa drone. Yemeni spokesperson Brigadier General Yahya Sari declared early Friday the drone is named after the Palestinian city occupied by Israel, now known as Tel Aviv. The UAV is designed, the unmanned air vehicle is designed with the specific aim of evading enemy radar and interception systems, Sari said. The drone reached its target and achieved its operational objectives. Okay? It emphasized that the Yemeni armed forces now consider the area of Tel Aviv to be a strike zone and a primary target for future operations. So, again, Israel, you fucked around. Now you are finding out. Yemen is absolutely not going to stop what it is doing. All right? It's not going to stop. And why? What would give anyone that impression? This has been going on since November 2023. When Ansar Allah stepped up, joined in with the Axis of Resistance, and instituted that blockade in the Red Sea that has devastated the Israeli economy and has coincided with the ongoing fighting between Hezbollah in the south of Lebanon against Israeli forces there. It coincides, of course, with what is happening in Palestine and in Gaza, and it coincides with the overall resistance from Iran in Operation True Promise. And we can go on and on and on with how the resistance has been coming together to come to the aid of Palestine. Now, I want to show you that this is, of course, not just a military affair. The Red Sea blockade has already caused bankruptcy for Eilat Port, the port that has received absolutely no economic activity or has been really just completely frozen since Yemen, since Ansar Allah has began its campaign. So this is according to the Middle East Monitor. What happens? It officially declared bankruptcy, 8 months of complete paralysis of commercial activity and a cessation of receiving ships and containers, especially coming from Asian country markets, carrying with them the needs of the economy and the industrial sector. This includes raw materials, intermediate goods, production inputs, machinery and equipment, crude oil and fuel, wheat, food, cars, and other market needs. So the reason for the bankruptcy was successive attacks launched by Ansar Allah on Israeli ships in the Red Sea and the Arabian Sea, as well as targeting of ships in countries supporting the occupation and the genocidal war it is waging against the people of Gaza, notably American and British ships. So shipping traffic declined 85% over this period, basically altogether stopped. And that is why there's bankruptcy in Eilat. That is a major achievement from the resistance, from Ansar Allah itself. And it only points to run front. So now, and I'm going to show you what I've been saying about this, because I think it is a point that should be made. So now we have one country, all right, I'm going to show you what I mean by this. One country has declared, a massive number of people in that country have declared that they are now at war with Israel. They are stepping up their resistance. And I said, yes, sure, Israel can do something like this. It can burn Hodeidah. It can cause damage. It can kill civilians. It can further hamper Yemen's economy. But what they cannot stop is this. They cannot stop the people that support Ansar Allah. They cannot stop the people who back Ansar Allah's efforts. And they cannot stop Ansar Allah, because if they could, that drone would have never hit Israel. Not only that, but we can expect this to get worse and worse for Israel. So over the last several months, we've heard Israel say that it will, and we heard it after its strike on Yemen, that, oh, you will pay the price if you attack us. Well, it's Israel that's actually paying a pretty steep price, because it is quickly finding itself mired and surrounded by resistance. So here is Hezbollah on the Lebanon front. This just happened, July 19th. Israeli officer succumbs to wounds from Golan attack as Hezbollah strikes new settlement. Okay, an Israeli officer died from wounds sustained from a Hezbollah attack in the occupied Golan Heights 2 weeks ago. So this happened actually earlier in July, and it's an update. And it said it attacked a new Israeli settlement on Friday for the first time. Retired officer Ephraim Ben Amram, 25, a soldier in the 53rd Battalion, died of his wounds about 2 weeks later after he was seriously injured in a drone attack launched in the south of Lebanon on a military base in the Golan Heights. Remember, what are the Golan Heights? They are Syrian territory occupied by Israel. At least 19 Israeli troops were injured at the end of June when Hezbollah launched a suicide drone attack on the territory, a Syrian plateau occupied by Israel since 1967. You heard that. Occupied by Israel. Israel does not belong there, yet they are there. Okay. As of Wednesday, Israel said 682 of its soldiers have died and more than 4,100 have been injured since the start of the war in Gaza and outbreak of hostilities along the Lebanon frontier. Now, you may think that is small, but most people understand that IDF numbers are likely fabrications, and actually the casualty numbers are probably much higher. While we cannot confirm this, we do know that the fierce fighting, the reason why Israel will not step up their operations against Hezbollah is because they know that whatever Yemen can do, Hezbollah can do to an even greater degree. So an Israeli airstrike destroyed a three-story building in the south of Lebanon, killing five people as of Thursday evening. So this was Thursday, July 18th, including a commander of Hezbollah's elite Redwan operational unit. The commander was identified as Ali Jafar Motouk. A second Hezbollah member was killed, identified as Hassan Ali Mana. So this is what's been happening. They've been killing Hezbollah leaders, Israel, and then Hezbollah strikes back. And Hezbollah has struck back in a pretty fierce way. It has completely emptied out the north of so-called Israel, okay? And we can see Hezbollah rocket attacks back in early July spark fires and destroy thousands of acres, okay? I think there might be a better picture here. There it is, all right? There is the scene of what northern Israel has looked like earlier the month of July. So you have Israel completely tied up in the Lebanon front. Okay, Israel does not have the capabilities to wage a broader war with Lebanon without being bombarded, right? I've shown that Israeli media itself has said that 1,000 missiles will rain on the head of Tel Aviv from Lebanon should Israel try to wage a larger war there. So you have the Lebanon front, okay? And I'm not even going to get into the Syrian and Iraq Islamic resistance, which is in and of itself significant too. But not only do you have Israel now being just drawn in, right? It is now entrapping itself into a larger regional war with Yemen, a small country that has been impoverished, that has been at war for years with Saudi Arabia and the UAE and the United States, completely decimated, but built up this incredible resistance force with all of its fierce and might and courage and now capability. So Israel is now getting deeper and deeper into conflict with Yemen. It's already mired in a conflict with Hezbollah that it keeps on threatening. It's going to expand. But there's one big problem for Israel, and that is that it is being embarrassed. It is being absolutely exposed as a fraud when it comes to the war in Gaza. This is what has to be noted. The Jerusalem Post itself, this is from back in May. This is what is so, I think, just emblematic of what Israel is right now. Israel is a state on the path of suicide. It's a colonial entity on the path toward its own destruction. But isn't that how they all go, right? So this larger regional war that is being sparked, that Yemen has just courageously stepped up to the plate over, this is Israel's grave that it is digging. Jerusalem Post says Israel has lost the war on Gaza. Israel has lost its war on the besieged Gaza Strip and failed to achieve its declared goals of the war, including eliminating Hamas and returning all the hostages, said Jerusalem Post. Remember, this is back at the end of May, in a damning critique of the occupation's far-right government. In an article published on Tuesday, this was back in late May, the newspaper said that even seizing and occupying the city of Rafah, which it claimed hides dozens of huge tunnels used by Hamas to smuggle weapons, ammunition, weapons, and vehicles, will not achieve these goals. It added that Hamas won on October 7th when its fighters embarrassed the much-vaunted Israeli military establishment, invaded military bases, killed many Israelis, and returned to Gaza with hostages. The movement, it pointed out, continues to be a force in Gaza despite destruction caused by the Israeli army. According to Israel's biggest circulation English language daily, established in 1932 as the Palestine Post, only changing its name in 1950, the most significant victory achieved by Hamas has been to put Palestinians back on the international agenda after years of neglect, making Israel a pariah in the world again and endangering the grand U.S. plan of forging an alliance between Israel and so-called moderate Arab nations. Does it make sense for Israel to continue pressing for the achievement of unachievable goals, or should it shift gears and work towards something attainable? Asked the newspaper. If the answer is the latter, Israel needs new leadership. So this is what Israel is trying to do. They are trying to paint, right? The Israeli establishment is trying to say this is Netanyahu, that he's an extremist. And all those things are true. Netanyahu is indeed a disaster. He's indeed a warmonger, a war criminal, and at the heart of what is going on in Gaza, that genocide. But it is the entire Israeli establishment. We cannot act like Yoav Gallant and these forces now saying that they are opposed to what Netanyahu is doing, are somehow benevolent, are somehow having anyone's interests at heart but their own. They are looking at their own self-preservation first and foremost. And that's what we have to remember, because what we are witnessing here is quite historic. We are witnessing the axis of resistance. Many U.S. observers, Western observers will say, this is all Iran. But Iran, you can see, is very far away from these operations, no matter how much military aid Iran might give to, let's say, Hezbollah or even Ansarallah. It cannot and does not dictate all of their operations, or any of their operations for that matter. We are seeing Ansarallah take a very just monumental step toward a major escalation, which Ansarallah and the people of Yemen see as absolutely necessary to ensuring the survival, not just of the Palestinian people, not just of themselves and the rest of the axis of resistance, but really for the entire region and the world. We cannot underscore that this, or understate, or minimize what it means to step up in this moment where so many countries cannot or do not. Remember, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, these countries that all run along the Red Sea as well, right? They have done absolutely nothing. Actually, Saudi Arabia has been re-provoking conflict with Yemen, has been escalating sanctions onto Yemen to try to starve them out. Why? Many people believe it's because it's at the behest of Israel. These countries, of course, have long histories of being essentially CIA cutouts themselves. But at this, in this day and age, where multipolarity is taking hold, where countries like Saudi Arabia are diversifying their international portfolio, saying that they are making bets on BRICS, on China, on Russia, they still have not done anything to the degree that is necessary to step up to the plate for Gaza. Instead, it is the axis of resistance that is doing so. In Yemen striking Israel, it is incredible to hear that Yemen has the capabilities not just to penetrate the Iron Dome, but to do it over and over and over and over again. Israel is going to think many times over about what it just did by bombing Hodeidah. They think that they have scared Yemen Ansarallah into giving up. They think that what they did is damage enough to ensure that these kind of operations won't continue. Nothing over the last almost a year now, nothing over the last 7+ months says anything of the sort. What has Yemen been doing? It has been hitting ship after ship after ship after ship. It has been diverting economic activity. It has played a huge hand in Israel's economic ailments. It has been making some of the biggest impact in this conflict that any other force has been making outside of the Palestinian resistance. And so now Israel picking a direct fight with Ansarallah only ensures that its destruction will come sooner rather than later. That is what it ensures, because you can't defeat the people. You cannot defeat a resistance. You can't name a resistance that has been defeated. You can name a resistance that has been held back, that has been pushed back, that has faced challenges. But over the course of history, if you look at this kind of resistance and where it falls, whether you're looking at Vietnam or even Afghanistan kicking out the United States, but if you look at countries like Vietnam, if you look at countries like Korea, we can go on and on and on. There's so many examples where resistance such as this leads ultimately to victory. And given the capabilities, right? These are capabilities that are serious, given Yemen's capabilities, given Hezbollah's capabilities, given Iran's. Forget just Iran alone. Iran takes a very measured position when it comes to Israel because it does not want to see a bloodbath in the region. It has the ability to ignite that. It has the ability to bring Israel to its knees if it wanted to, but it doesn't. Why? Because an attempt to do so would, if in fact, engender an absolutely devastating war that would bring everyone else in the crosshairs. It isn't as if Iran and Israel share a border. This would bring in the entire axis of resistance. It would bring in the entire region. We would see a war that would also bring in the United States. And who knows what kind of carnage could come out of that. That is the only reason why Iran hasn't done more than what it has, which has been quite significant in a lot of respects. This is why the axis of resistance as a whole has taken a measured escalatory approach. Yes, the sacrifice has been big, but now we are seeing the fruits being born, and we will continue, I believe, to see more and more attacks on Israel to come. More and more will be coming, because at the end of the day, we are talking about a colonial entity. We are talking about a genocide committed by this colonial entity that has no end in sight. And the axis of resistance understands this. And most of the world at this point understands this. Netanyahu will come to Congress on the 24th of July, and he will give a speech talking about how he basically runs the show, how his country's interests, his occupation forces' interests are the most important interests, and that the United States needs to do what it's been doing, which is essentially giving everything that it needs to commit absolute wanton war, criminality, genocide, and massacres. That's what he is going to do, and that is why the axis of resistance is taking these measures to stop it. Now, the axis of resistance needs more help. That help will have to come in the form of people in the collective West, people in the United States, saying no more to this genocide and actually putting in a concerted effort in action to stop it from happening. What does that look like? Well, you can let me know in the comments. You can let me know what it may look like wherever you can comment in this video, in this live stream, if you are watching it live.
when the generator's on, till the